Good morning, dear colleagues. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service here at the UN in Geneva. Today is Friday, 19 September, and I would like to immediately start but with a little change in our agenda by giving the floor immediately to our colleague in Kabul. We have the pleasure to have with us this morning Susan Ferguson, who is the UN Women's Special Representative in Afghanistan, connecting from Kabul, as I said, to tell us about the situation of women and girls in the aftermath of the earthquake that has struck the country. So, Susan, if you wish to start with your introductory remarks, and then we will open the floor to questions. And thanks for being with us. I know it has been complicated to organize this briefing, but we are very happy to have you here. Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for having me today. Women and girls continue to bear the brunt of the Afghanistan earthquake, one of the deadliest in the country's recent history. While the major aftershocks have passed, or mostly passed, women in affected areas are facing a long-term disaster without more urgent assistance. Tragically, women and girls account for over half of those killed and injured and 60% of those still missing. Now, on top of their grief and loss, survivors are facing new threats, including heightened risks of violence and exploitation and a lack of access to support and services. As I saw when I visited a village in Kunar province last week, many families remain in tents or out in the open. Sanitation and water infrastructure has been destroyed, and there are not enough latrines for women and girls in villages or informal settlements. This means they're having to walk further to go to the bathroom or gather water, exposing them to the risk of violence and landmines. The increased risk of violence carries into households as well. Too often there are spikes in gender-based violence following disasters, triggered by the intense pressure on communities through displacement, loss of livelihoods, and more. In the earthquake, one of the most impacted groups are women-headed households, and we know of at least 463 of these families in the affected areas. In everyday life, in this cultural context, these women already face an uphill battle every day to survive and support their families. Now, in the disruption and chaos following the earthquake, these women will find it exponentially harder to feed their children and find a safe place to stay. Pregnant and breastfeeding women are also affected. They and all women and girls will need access to health services. Due to the bans on women working for NGOs and studying at university, mobility restrictions imposed by the de facto authorities, and systemic discrimination, there's a serious shortage of women health workers across Afghanistan. As highlighted in our recent gender alert, issued by the Gender and Humanitarian Action Working Group in Afghanistan, of which UN Women is a co-lead, the impact on women's livelihoods has also been devastating. With large numbers of livestock killed or injured, many women have lost their income and can't afford food or other basics. It's crucial that early recovery measures include livelihood support. Women are also disproportionately impacted by the earthquake when it comes to accessing humanitarian assistance. As highlighted in a new humanitarian update released this week by UN Women, many women are still struggling to access support. This is partly due to conservative norms, which can make it hard for them to move around independently or to find out about the services available. But it also shows the crucial importance of women humanitarians who can speak to other women about the help available and provide services, including mental health and psychosocial support, in a culturally appropriate way. Before I speak to that, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge that Afghan women have been present and working tirelessly on the front lines since day one. For example, with the support of UN Women and other UN agencies, women make up 40% now of all the joint assessment teams, which have reached 134 out of 411 affected villages. They can speak directly with affected women and girls and hear what support they need. These teams have been going to extraordinary lengths to reach those in need, trekking for hours on foot as many roads were damaged or blocked by landslides. One of the women we supported on these teams described scrambling along the sides of mountains, dodging falling rocks every time there was an aftershock. Another woman who joined these teams, again with our support, said there was no other channel for women to share their needs and concerns as they're restricted from speaking to men. Some women are also being deployed with mobile teams, bringing healthcare, psychosocial support, and other critical services directly to women. And they're helping to distribute aid from the UN and NGOs, including cash, blankets, and through emergency hubs. They've played a remarkable role to date, but we need more of them. There are still not enough women humanitarian workers in the response. And there are many reasons for this, including an ongoing lack of investment in women's staff as part of existing aid budgets, and the previous ban by the de facto authorities on women working for NGOs announced in 2022, and then on the UN announced in 2023. At the time, UN Women committed it would not replace its women's staff with male staff, and we stand firmly by that commitment. Throughout all these increasing restrictions, UN Women has remained on the ground, working with partners to find localized solutions to support women and girls. And we continue to demand that Afghan women working with the United Nations can continue their work without prohibitions or restrictions. The latest DFA edict on Afghan women colleagues entering UN compounds puts at serious risk the delivery of life-saving humanitarian assistance and other essential services to women and girls affected by the earthquake. Having women in humanitarian roles is especially vital to ensure women and girls can safely access the support they need, which must be delivered by women for women. There is no other option to provide principled assistance. Without women aid workers, we simply will not be able to meet the needs of women and girls in the weeks and months ahead. While it's still warm in the earthquake-affected areas, winter is fast approaching. Living conditions and humanitarian access will become even more difficult, which is why UN Women is appealing for $2.5 million to expand a 6 to 12 month emergency response and recovery plan. Under this plan, we will scale up women's participation in the response and increase access to services in partnership with women's organisations. We're partnering with 5 women-led and women-focused organisations at the moment to address the immediate needs of women and girls across Kunar province, including by providing items such as blankets, clothing and cooking utensils, and supplies to cope with the winter cold. We're also providing cash assistance and protection services, including mental health and psychosocial support. And we're also establishing safe spaces where women and girls can meet and access humanitarian support. But we need to do more to target 30,000 individuals, primarily women and girls. It's important to remember that many of the women and girls currently traumatized after this earthquake have already been through significant upheaval in their lives after returning from Iran or Pakistan. This disaster will only compound the distress and economic pressures they were already facing. Last week, when I was in Kunar province, one of the worst affected areas, I sat with a group of women in an earthquake affected village. We met in a stiflingly hot tent with a dirt floor, and soon that ground will freeze as winter approaches. These women had fled their village in the middle of the night when the earthquake struck, walking for hours to find temporary shelter. They told me they'd lost their relatives, many still buried in the rubble. They lost their homes, they lost their livelihoods and their source of income. As one woman said to me, "Now we have nothing." Yet as long as there are women humanitarians on the ground, there is hope that women like this woman will be able to access support and services. And to quote one of these aid workers, "I asked if I could be deployed there because I wanted to support women and girls." And we must invest more in the commitment, courage, and sense of community shown by Afghan women humanitarians during this disaster. I call again on the international community to provide more urgent support through women's organisations to ensure more women humanitarians are on the front lines. It's the only way women and girls will get the care they need and slowly begin to rebuild their lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Susan, for this very comprehensive briefing. I'll open now the floor to questions. Oh, no, sorry. I'm sorry, Jeremy. Jeremy is going to add something on the OHCHR side. Sorry.
Yes.
It's an addendum.
Thanks, Alessandra. Yeah, listen, I would just like to speak to what the words of our colleague has just said regarding the decision on September 7 where the de facto security forces prevented female staff members and contractors of the UN from entering UN compounds in Kabul. Through a written or verbal notification, the restriction was in fact expanded to UN field officers countrywide on the 8th and 9th of September. This ban and its reinforcement are part of a series of ongoing restrictions in Afghanistan affecting women and girls' enjoyment to their rights, effectively excluding them from public life and confining them to their homes. It is unlawful under international human rights law given its fundamental discrimination of women per the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. That's CEDAW, that you all know. It is also an overt contravention of international rules on the privileges and immunities of the United Nations, including those extended to all UN personnel, including Afghan female staff members. The UN in Afghanistan is engaging the de facto authorities at the highest levels to protest the actions of the de facto authorities, and we would like to reiterate their call for the immediate lifting of the restrictions so humanitarian access, assistance and critical services are delivered to the Afghan people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Thanks for adding this. I'll open the floor to question. Now I see Nina Larson from AFP.
Yeah, thank you very much for the briefing. I was hoping you could say a little bit about what impact the ban has had. I mean, there was a mention that 40% of the teams have women on them. So are on the ground, are you seeing the ban play out? And then also, there have been reports that during the rescue work, women were not rescued because men could not access them. Do you have any information about that or any numbers about how this has impacted rescue of women and girls? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nina. Susan, can you take this?
Yes, thank you very much for the questions. So the ban is impacting us because our women's staff are not allowed to come to the office to work. However, women's staff are, and women in the humanitarian response are still able to operate in the earthquake affected sites. And this is really essential and has been recognized actually as essential by the DFA authorities as well. So women continue to be a part of that response. But it's also why it's so important that we are able to provide funding for our women-led organisations on the ground, because they also are being mobilised through humanitarian support that comes to UN Women. And on the situation for the reports about women being left behind, when I was in the earthquake affected area, I met with a number of women health workers and also women themselves who were affected by the earthquake. And I also met and went to the hospital, the regional hospital, which had 44% women patients and 56% men. So I think that indicates that there hasn't been a systemic discrimination against providing support to either women or men. And what I heard from health workers and from some women was that there was a particular area in the earthquake affected zone where there were cultural norms that meant that women themselves didn't want men to touch them, and that men also didn't want to touch women as they were trying to rescue them. But this was actually much more a reflection of the social norms from that particular area than from DFA particular discrimination.
Thank you very much. Terrible. Nina, you have a follow-up? No? Any other question? I don't see other hands up online or in the room. So thank you very much, Susan, for this briefing and answers. And thanks to Jeremy for adding on the human rights side. Please keep us informed on how things will be going, and stay safe. And good luck, all the best for your very important work. Thank you very much. So let's go
thank
now
you
to
so
the...
Much.
Thank you for being with us. So let's go now to the second subject of our briefing of today, which is Sudan. We have several colleagues here to brief you on the situation in Sudan. On my left, Jeremy is accompanied by Li Fung, who's the representative of OHCHR in Sudan. They have a new report coming out on Sudan. And to my right, I've got the pleasure to have Patrick Youssef. I don't need to introduce you to him, the ICRC Regional Director for Africa, and who is accompanied by Jean-Yves Clemenceau, the Head of Sector Communication Africa, also from ICRC. They're all going to tell you about their activities in Sudan, another terrible crisis of our time. Maybe I'll start with OHCHR. I don't know who would like to. Jeremy? Okay.
Thank you, Alessandra. This morning, our office published a report on the human rights situation in Sudan covering the first half of this year. Our report finds that the conflict-driven crisis has intensified, pointing to a rise in civilian killings, including summary executions, amid growing ethnic violence and a worsening humanitarian situation. Most of the civilian killings occurred in Darfur, Kordofan, and Khartoum. Overall, the number of killings documented in the first half of this year represents about 80% of the total documented in the whole of last year. Several major offensives and mass casual incidents were particularly deadly. In April, an offensive by the Rapid Support Forces in El Fasher and other areas in North Darfur resulted in at least 527 deaths, including over 270 in Zamzam and Abu Shouk camps for displaced people. In March, airstrikes by the Sudan Armed Forces on Tora Market in North Darfur killed at least 350 civilians, including 13 members of one family. The report also documents the unlawful killing of at least 990 civilians outside the conduct of hostilities, including through summary executions. Between February and April, the number of such killings tripled, due in a large part to a surge in summary executions, primarily in Khartoum, after the Sudanese armed forces and allied fighters recaptured territory previously controlled by the Rapid Support Forces in late March, and campaigns of apparent reprisals against alleged collaborators ensued. One witness who observed SAF search operations in civilian neighbourhoods in East Nile, Khartoum, between March and April, said that he saw children as young as 14 and 15 years of age, accused of being RSF members, summarily killed. RSF also carried out summary executions in Khartoum as SAF and allied fighters closed in on their positions. On the 27th of April, video footage obtained by our office shows the summary execution by RSF fighters of at least 30 males in civilian dress, including some who appeared to be children, in Al Salah in Omdurman, after they were accused of affiliation with SAF. This violence, in all of its vile forms, must end. Impunity continues to drive cycles of violations and abuses. To stop this, accountability is critical to hold those responsible to account. Sudan's conflict is a forgotten one, and we hope that this report puts the spotlight on the disastrous situation where atrocity crimes, including war crimes, are being committed. The conflict has also led to the world's largest humanitarian crisis. Millions face acute food insecurity and lack access to safe water and sanitation. And cholera is on the rise. Yet still attacks continue on health facilities, markets, energy infrastructure, water sources, and humanitarian convoys. At least 30 humanitarian and health workers and 7 media workers have been killed in the 6-month period. The report also documents widespread arbitrary detention, often targeting individuals accused of being collaborators and involving ethnic profiling. States must collectively face up to the grim reality of what has now evolved into a wider and alarming protection crisis, and to use their influence to end this conflict. Many more lives will be lost without urgent action to protect civilians and without the rapid and unhindered delivery of humanitarian aid. You should have all received a full version of the news release along with the report. My colleague Lee Fung here, who heads our Sudan operation and was only in Port Sudan last week, is here with us today. She can take your questions on the report itself and give you the latest update on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you. Since the close of the period covered by our report, we have been alarmed by developments in North Darfur, in particular the situation in El Fasher, which continues to rapidly deteriorate. Over the past few days, we have received further reports of artillery shelling by the Rapid Support Forces and incursions into the Abu Shouk IDP camp. Around 90% of the camp's population has been displaced by such violence in recent months. Since the beginning of August, at least 207 civilians have been killed in El Fasher, including in Abu Shouk camp, although the death toll is likely much higher. This includes 159 killed during hostilities, largely as a result of artillery shelling, and at least 48 summary executions. Taking into account the dire humanitarian crisis due to the continuing siege and the severe shortages of food, water and medicine, the reality on the ground in El Fasher is horrific. Every day we are receiving more reports of horrors on the ground. Just this morning, reports have reached us of dozens of civilians killed in a mosque during prayer time, likely due to bombardment. We continue to receive reports of civilians being killed, abducted, or subjected to sexual violence while attempting to leave El Fasher. There are no safe exit routes out of the city, and civilians are trapped in a situation of impossible choice. Either stay in El Fasher and risk bombardment, starvation, and atrocities if the RSF overrun the city, or flee and face the risk of summary execution, sexual violence, and abduction. We are witnessing a recurrence of similar patterns when the RSF seized Zamzam IDP camp near El Fasher in April. During a mission ARC office conducted to eastern Chad in early July, we interviewed over 150 victims and witnesses who had fled Zamzam and El Fasher. They described systematic violations and abuses, often ethnically motivated, including summary executions, targeting of health workers, abductions, and targeted sexual violence against women and girls based on their ethnic identity and perceived affiliation with the Sudanese Armed Forces and Joint Forces. One survivor described her escape from Zamzam camp, saying, "I realized that RSF soldiers were everywhere on the road to Tawila and that I was going to be raped no matter what." Based on these patterns, we fear recurrence of ethnically motivated violence in Abu Shouk camp in Al-Afasha city. This adds to the grim picture of the first 6 months of 2025, as documented in our report released today. As you heard, the report documents widespread arbitrary detention across the country, often targeting individuals accused of collaborating with the opposing side. We have documented horrific conditions and abuses in places of detention, including torture and ill treatment, and deprivation of food, water, and medical care, leading to deaths in custody. Civic space has been increasingly constrained as civil society figures, including local humanitarian volunteers, have been subjected to arbitrary detention, restrictions, and attacks. And we have documented numerous incidents involving hate speech and incitement to violence. This raises concerns about the ethnicization of the conflict, drawing upon long-standing discrimination and inequalities, and the long-lasting impacts this will have on society and social cohesion in Sudan. The conflict continues to have wide-ranging impacts on daily life. During my recent visits to Port Sudan, I have had the opportunity to engage with women-led organizations, with persons with disabilities, and with displaced women and children. They have recounted the impacts of the conflict and of the displacement crisis on health, water and sanitation, housing, education, and work. Our office continues to work with civil society organizations, including those representing marginalized groups, to ensure their voices are heard and their needs are addressed. It is clear that civilians continue to bear the brunt of violence in this conflict, which has continued for too long. Once again, we call for an end to the conflict, for the protection of civilians, for unimpeded humanitarian access, and ultimately for international humanitarian law and human rights law to be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lufung. And I'll now give the floor to our colleagues over the ICRC. I don't know, Patrick, you want to start?
Yes, thank you so much. And just before we start, it's just to confirm or also congratulate also my colleagues on the clarity of their reporting and the accounts that in many ways we and our teams indeed witness on the ground. And I think if we have to carry one message to the head of the United Nations General Assembly is that violence against civilians must stop. As simple as that, as simple as this account may sound, it is extremely, extremely complicated for humanitarian organizations to ensure that the 3,400 people that were killed, again in the human rights report, that not occur constantly and eventually become the norm in a country like Sudan. So I wanted to say I wish I was here to tell you how many schools have reopened or how many kids have been vaccinated or even how humanitarian services have been increased either by local actors or international actors, but we're far from that. And allow me please to say that this is not just neglected, forgotten, but mostly ignored because from the accounts of many journalists here in the room, but also all humanitarian organizations are screaming and shouting for attention on Sudan. And I hope this becomes now more and more of a trend to, yes, focus on the Middle East, on Ukraine, but do not forget that these crises don't have impacts only on Sudan, but they destabilize, as you see now, the whole of the Horn of Africa. Allow me to focus on three things, and I'm not going to bore you with the details that you know, specifically on the numbers of displaced and people that took refuge in other countries. Allow me to speak first about the conflict, which was mentioned now. It's intensifying, and it's that intensification means that the parties to the conflicts have more capacities, be that military or human, and that is indeed mean to see that, unfortunately, the armed conflict in different parts of the country are not stopping. On the contrary, new front lines are being perceived, and one, indeed, around Al-Fashir, which is one of the worst humanitarian crises I've seen, with Al-Fashir being under siege since a couple of months now, blocking humanitarian aid and exacerbating the crisis. Those who managed to run away, 500,000 of those have reached Tawila. And again, reaching Tawila means you are getting into a place where are no shelters, no adequate living spaces. People are living in open fields. That's what the ICRC and the Sudanese Red Crescent colleagues give as accounts. And many have walked barefoot for days in extreme heat. And therefore, I think it is a humanitarian imperative today to put and shed light on the situation in Al-Fashir and the whole of the north of Darfur, and especially for those who are running away to get to places like in Chad, not to be able to be received by humanitarian organizations for different reasons, namely budget cuts or budget provisions that haven't considered a mass influx of refugees from Al-Fashir into other places. And again, Tawila is another case in point. I think the second piece of information I wanted to share is, again, on the cholera outbreak. You've seen our public communication about the cholera being a symptom. That epidemic is simply a symptom of destruction of the health facilities, the water pumping stations that we would count on for people to receive fresh and clean water are simply unoperable. And hence, that signals that the critical infrastructure during armed conflict needs to be preserved, and that the Geneva Conventions are not just letters on paper, but if implemented, could truly save lives, could have truly saved the 2,500 people that were killed, because in the 21st century, we were not able to provide medical services to these people or provide them with clean water. And it's exactly the same reason why so many Sudanese, I would say 100% of them, and those living in Sudan are unfortunately affected by this crisis, which has unfortunately again reached many levels. The doctors and nurses in Al Jazeera East Hospital in Al Basharga or Al Jazeera State are simply busy treating patients who have cholera, rather than fixing the wounds of those who were affected by the armed conflict. And we have seen that our teams, and thankfully there are some people still left in the country, like in Adbara Reference Hospital, where our teams have managed to treat 18,000 people, have delivered medicines and medical aid to Al Saudi Hospital and Al Fashir, or to other places, especially in Khartoum. But again, these are a small drop in the sea of needs. We're obviously focusing on delivering assistance, water, food, maintaining the kitchens, the community kitchens that we've erected with the Sudanese Red Crescent, but also supporting the only working hospital now in Al-Fashir. Our teams have managed to provide cash for 45,000 people in Tawila, mainly, again, displaced from Al-Fashir, but then trying to help and treat the cholera patients with everything we can. And that response is clearly led by the humanitarian organizations with the support of the local authorities. I think that we need to focus not just on Darfur, also on Kordofan, and again on the clear situation in Khartoum. But we also have to see that the rainy season will obviously increase the risk of outbreaks. The rainy season will certainly increase the difficulty of mobility for those trying to flee war zones. And I think we need to clearly put it out there. And maybe the last point I wanted to mention, and again, happy to take more questions. I hope that everyone in the room knows exactly what's happening in Sudan or has the sound bites and the images to come with that. The last one is our team visited Khartoum quite quickly after the seizure of the Sudanese armed forces, and found that literally in every, if not every, but in many locations, namely around hospitals, or around other social services and structures, we found a lot of dead bodies, a lot of mortal remains being buried hastily because of the war. And today, with the help of the authorities and the Sudanese Red Crescent, we're trying to be part of all the exhumations so that we identify those people, notify their families that they were found, and that they indeed receive a dignified burial with a clear identification. Again, the war is not about only saving lives with food and water, but it's also about those who remain behind waiting for news from their families. Colleagues mentioned the detention question. People have been detained, and it's exactly why we keep on calling for both parties to allow for verifications and visits to these places of detention. Again, if the intention is to go to peace, then the courageous thing to do is to respect the Geneva Conventions during war in order to pave the way for a peaceful resolution of this crisis. Otherwise, we're going to pile up humanitarian crises that have become irreversible in nature and in volume. And in that, we will be screaming and shouting after the cessation of hostilities to find $1 or 1 Swiss franc to support those infrastructures that could have been saved during the war, which we see now are systematically attacked. And again, it is not an exaggeration to say 80% of the hospitals have ceased to exist, completely destroyed as we've seen in Khartoum, or have been run with very limited capacities, unfortunately, because of this crisis. And the last but not least, again, there are hundreds of calls of action that we can indeed get out there. But again, if the war consists and continues, then the parties are asked to honor what they signed in Jeddah in the form of the Jeddah Declaration, which is full of recommendations for the troops, for the soldiers on the ground, to respect the civilians, to respect the hospitals and the infrastructure, and allow unimpeded humanitarian access for ourselves and the list of humanitarian organizations that can indeed make a difference. We're not in a conundrum here. We're able to save lives and change the unfortunate reality that every Sudanese is haunted by. But again, we are unable to do so, except with the small things that we manage still to do: war surgery in Atbara, dead body management in many parts of Sudan, assisting here and there. But again, I think we all agree that this is a protection crisis to start with. If people do not feel protected, even what I heard is that 2 million Sudanese have returned to their country, again, not verified, but what would they return to? Which house will harbor them? Which hospital will provide them with healthcare? And these are basically numbers, and we should turn these numbers into positive realities and try and change that narrative from the atrocities that we see into something much more hopeful for a country the size that you know and the importance that you know culturally, religiously, and ethnically for the whole of the East Africa, but also for the Middle East. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Jean-Yves?
Yes, just
the microphone.
Yeah, just to flag that on cholera, we have and we will distribute you footage. We have testimonies of people affected, of our teams responding. It's the worst cholera outbreak in Sudan for 4 years, and I think this is an interesting material for you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all the speakers. Let me open the floor to questions. Now, Agnes Pedrero, AFP.
Yes, thank you. Some questions to Red Cross and Human Rights. So to Human Rights, the report mentioned the ethnicization of the conflict. Do you think that it's going in direction of ethnic cleansing? If you could explain a little bit, what does it mean, the ethnicization, sorry? And what kind of ethnic are you talking about? And then on cholera, so you just say that it's the worst since for some years. When was the last major crisis? And you mentioned 12,500 deaths. Sorry if I missed that. Was it for this year or since the beginning of the conflict? And if the situation is ongoing like it's now, how many deaths you think the epidemic could do in the next months? How it's how it's growing, how much fast it's growing. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll start with Li Feng.
Thank you. In terms of ethnicization of the conflict, we're really referring to the ethnic motivations and dimensions in various violations and abuses that we have documented throughout the report. This includes in summary killings, in arbitrary arrest and detention, in sexual violence, that this is a motivating factor. Particularly, we have witnessed in North Darfur, around Zamzam camp, but also now in Abu Shouk, that violence is being directed on an ethnic basis, based on identity. And I think that this is very, very worrying in terms of where this leads in terms of social cohesion. In terms of your question in relation to ethnic cleansing, what our report has found is that we've documented serious violations which may amount to war crimes and other crimes under international law, including atrocity crimes. We are not drawing any legal conclusions, but the facts are there and the testimonies are there.
Thank you very much. Patrick?
Thank you. On the cholera outbreak, in fact, cholera occurs in many pockets in Sudan, but also in the neighboring countries, so it's not a big surprise. However, when you speak about 110,000 people affected in one shot, that reminds us of the 2019 cholera outbreak. That was the biggest. There was a small one in 2023, but 2019 was one, unfortunately, where indeed it hit many, many areas. And we recall that in August 2016, there was also a huge cholera outbreak, namely in Kordofan and in Darfur. Now, I think on the question of the spread, I believe that with now a containment measure by the Ministry of Health and a lot of humanitarian organizations, I think we can say that we're lucky that we're in Tawila, otherwise it would have spread across. But today the figures are on Khartoum, and that's why we said we're focusing with the Ministry of Health on specific areas, not everywhere, where the acute needs are. 2,500 since beginning of June, if I'm not mistaken, is a big, big number. And therefore, that will certainly increase. But now with the rehydration, with the chlorination, with all the measures that are put in place, we truly hope, and with the manpower and the mind power, collective intelligence with those who lived that in the past, we really pray that it's contained within days or weeks, not more than that, because again, if we start with the rainy season, and I think in this same room when we spoke about the water contamination in Khartoum back in end of 2023, we were afraid of exactly the same reason. And again today, I hope that the containment becomes much more acute. Rather than more death, we would see much more attention on maybe other issues like malnutrition or other forms of vulnerabilities for the local population, namely in Kordofan, in Tawila more specifically, because of the double vulnerability these populations have been living. But my worst nightmare would be a bigger spread in Khartoum, obviously, if the populations want to return back to Khartoum. And that was the message our team carried to Khartoum with the help of the authorities, is to start and quickly work on the infrastructure, with the help of the African Development Bank, which I salute from here, that has really pledged a lot of support, not just financial, but manpower and expertise. And we hope that the Islamic Development Bank and others would really join that work. If you've seen also that the Quad, the US, KSA, UAE, and Egypt's announcement, I think this is also a measure of political support coming to help us and help other organizations increase humanitarian response, especially when we call that an imperative to respond. Cholera is one of them, obviously.
Thanks to both speakers. Yes, do you have a follow-up, Agnes?
Yes, to the human rights. Sorry for the question, but you are talking about ethnicization. Could you spell better what are the different ethnic that are involved? Thank you.
Sudan's a very diverse nation with many tribes and identities, and this has really been at the heart of discrimination, division and conflicts for decades, particularly in Darfur in the early 2000s. So what it is we're looking specifically, for example, giving you some examples, certain tribes or ethnic communities are seen as being supportive of certain parties because the parties to the conflict, because the leadership comes from certain tribes. For example, what we have seen in Zamzam and now in Abu Shouk is that the Zaghawa community is being targeted. It is because the leadership of groups within the SAF-aligned joint forces are Zaghawa. So they're perceived as being supporters of the SAF. At the same time, we've also seen that in other parts of the country, there is a mistrust, there's an assumption that people coming from the west of Sudan, from the Darfur and Kordofan regions, where the RSF has control over large areas, or the majority of the area, that particularly from certain tribes, that they are seen as supporters of the RSF. So they will then be profiled in terms of arrest and detention. So it's very complicated. It's getting much more complicated by the ongoing mobilization of civilians and recruitment by the parties, which is also from different tribes. And it spirals into this broader divisions within society.
Very clear. Thank you very much. Any other question on Sudan? In the room or online? I don't see any. Oh no, there is one, sorry. John Zarokostas, France 24. Ah, pardon. John.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering if the panel of experts have any update on the food situation and the risk of famine in some of the IDPs in the country. Thanks very much.
I'd like to say a word. Yes, on that, it's the risk of severe malnutrition is always there. Why? Because the delivery of food assistance on one side is not steady. We are unable to ensure that every 3 months we be able to deliver. We have the three community kitchens in Al-Fashir. But again, that's for 80,000 people. That's not enough. So the risk of famine is always high in a country like Sudan. And I think the reason why, and we spelled it out very clearly in 2024, when Al Jazeera state was taken over by the Sudanese armed forces, that the main question is how to ensure that food systems and agriculture can become the norm rather than food distributions in Sudan. And we even called upon a number of actors to work with WFP and others so that we can create together, and that's why the African Development Bank was very interested in trying to sustain the livelihoods of people and redress their own situation by themselves rather than come and create dependency with our humanitarian assistance. But even there, we're not able to deliver everywhere, and especially, and I think the worst nightmare for us is still Zamzam camp and Al-Fashir.
Tu avais levé la main. Pardon, Dorian.
Oui. I have a question for the ICRC. You said Sudan was not a forgotten crisis, but an ignored one. I'm just wondering, you know, what is the main impact of this on the humanitarian response? Is it just the resources? Is it the safety access? What are the top challenges, basically, of the humanitarians there?
You know, when a crisis is ignored, states tend to put the humanitarian cart to pull, indeed, a political process behind. And the other way should happen, in fact. And that's what we see on Sudan. We need much more voices, much more attention, but also some actions and concrete, resolute actions by states to influence, basically, the parties. Can you imagine that since April 2023, there was not a single ceasefire acted upon since the beginning of this war? That's exactly what we mean by ignored. It's not just the, you know, how much we invade the communication space and use the word Sudan and start being happy by the number of likes and retweets. It's really about carrying the Sudan crisis, offering alternatives or incentives to the parties to look at peace rather than the war as the only mean to solve their differences. But again, that's not the ICRC nor the UN, by the way, who could do that. It's really a coalition of states. It's the African Union. It's what the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia tried to do. And hence, that's why I allowed myself to speak of the Quad and the promise to meet at the margins of the United Nations General Assembly, because that would certainly bring an impetus to the peace process or to the cessation of hostilities process. Let's not call it peace because we're far from that, so that we allow humanitarian corridors or an invasion with the right generosity by humanitarian actors, which are not lacking only funds, but we're lacking more space to act, more security for our staff to be able to respond. Don't forget, we lost 4 colleagues. The Sudanese Red Crescent lost over 20 colleagues only in 2 years, and that is just more than enough to explain the dire situation of humanitarians trying to cross every front line in Sudan.
Yeah, and in this sense, I'd like to recall the work that Ramtan Lamamra, the personal envoy of the Secretary General for Sudan, has been doing all along this crisis. But I think you are absolutely right, Patrick, and we really hope that your coverage will help putting the spotlight on this crisis. I don't see. Oh yes, Nina.
Sorry, it's on another subject, for human rights.
To whom? To human rights? Rights. Yeah. Okay, so let me thank our colleagues who have been briefing on Sudan. It's very important that we continue speaking about that. Thanks to our colleagues of ICRC. Thanks to Li Feng. Can you stay on the podium 1 second, Jeremy? So, grazie a voi. Thank you. Merci. And I'm seeing on the chat a request for the B-roll, so I'll connect the journalists with you afterwards. Thank you. Okay, so Nina, please go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks. Hi, Jeremy. I was wondering if you could say something about the, if you have any reflections on the firing of Jimmy Kimmel in the United States, which is being seen as clear censorship from the country that has been at the forefront of freedom of expression for a very long time. So if you had any comments on that. And also in the same vein, there's the issue of the General Assembly, which is starting next week, and Palestinians will not be there. President Abbas will not be there because he's not been granted a visa. If you have any comments on sort of the rights implications of that. Thank you.
Yes. So, listen, Charlie Kirk's killing has triggered an important wider debate in the US and beyond about freedom of expression and its core relevance to a healthy, democratic, and pluralistic society. Now, I think it's important to state right that the murder of Charlie Kirk last week, quite rightly, led to a broad condemnation across US society. Violence against the person is never justified as a response to expression of political views, however strongly disagreement may be. In international, back to the Jimmy Kimmel thing. So in international human rights law, restrictions on freedom of expression must be in pursuit of a legitimate aim and necessary and proportionate to achieve that aim. All state entities and officials are bound to this standard. I think I can leave it there.
Sorry, my second question on Abbas not being and the ban on visa.
That's not really, wouldn't be really for me to speak on. Maybe
yeah.
It's more from...
Well, As we have said, I mean, the spokesperson of the Secretary General said this at various occasions, especially at the noon briefing, that we really hope that the host country will abide to its obligations under the host country agreement and the headquarters agreement. And I know that, the contacts continue to see if this decision can be reversed, but we do hope that the host country will abide to its obligations under these two agreements. Ravikant.
Thank you. My question again is about freedom of expression. And this time I'm talking about India, where internet independent channels have been severely curtailed on false grounds. There is a fear of arrests as well as cancellation of licenses on account of, you know, independent assessments and opinions. How dire is the situation in India, according to you?
I can't speak specifically to the India situation until I get some more specific details with which you're referring to. But suffice to say, tapping into what I was saying earlier, freedom of expression is one of the core components of the human rights. What a human is, their rights, they are entitled to, whether it be freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, freedom of assembly. And these must be treasured, must be protected.
Ravi, okay, no, he has put down his hand. Okay, so if there are no other questions to Jeremy, I let him go. I don't see any hand up, Jeremy. Thank you very much for these multiple answers. And now let me turn to Anktad. Catherine, you have an announcement.
Oui, bonjour à tous. Nous allons publier la semaine prochaine l'étude sur les transports maritimes. Le transport maritime représente plus de 80% des échanges de marchandises dans le monde. C'est pourquoi, lorsqu'il est malmené, que ce soit par des événements climatiques, des tensions politiques ou encore des politiques commerciales incertaines, le commerce est touché de plein fouet et, incidemment, le développement économique. Ce sont toujours, évidemment, aussi les économies les plus vulnérables qui en font le plus grand frais. C'est précisément cette situation qui fait l'objet de cette nouvelle étude sur les transports maritimes. C'est le plus ancien rapport de la CNUSED. Et cette série de rapports annuels sur le transport maritime a débuté en 1971. Dans cette nouvelle étude, la CNUSED fait des recommandations qui vont dans le sens de la stabilisation des politiques commerciales, de la transition numérique et durable du secteur du transport maritime, et également dans le sens du soutien apporté aux pays en développement, et elle élabore sur les manières de le faire. La conférence de presse, donc, pour vous présenter ce rapport, se tiendra mercredi prochain à 14h30 dans cette salle, avec les auteurs du rapport. Vous avez reçu ce matin le dossier de presse. Vous n'avez que l'overview, le résumé du rapport. Le rapport sera disponible un petit peu plus tard. Et la version espagnole des communiqués sera disponible dans la journée. Actuellement, le français et l'anglais sont en ligne dans la salle de presse virtuelle. On vous enverra la version espagnole donc dans la journée. Donc je rappelle, la publication sera mercredi 24 septembre, la conférence de presse à 14h30, et tout ça est sous embargo jusqu'à 17h, heure de Genève, le même jour. Voilà, c'est tout pour moi. Merci.
Merci à toi, Catherine. Question ? Oui, Nina.
Sorry, it's on another side. I was just wondering if Tariq is still online. I had a question for Tariq for WHO.
Let me see if there are questions for Catherine first. And we still have an announcement. I don't see any Catherine. So good luck with the press conference. And thanks for this announcement. Nina, if you allow me, before I give the floor for Tariq, I just would like to hear from the ILO. Zeina, are you online? Zeina has an announcement for you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, okay, there you are.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alessandra, and good morning, colleagues. You have probably received by email from us the embargoed material for our upcoming State of Social Justice report. Now, this is a major report, a new flagship report from the ILO, where we look at the state of social justice in the world, including key indicators such as poverty reduction, education, and productivity. And the report really has quite important information, some new data and some new analysis on where we are at in our pursuit of social justice and some of the key indicators, some of which are related to the SDGs. The report itself will launch in New York during the UN General Assembly on the 23rd of September, but it is, of course, available under embargo. And the embargo lifts at 19:15 local time, 17:15 GMT on the 23rd of September. We also have a number of experts and spokespersons who are available should you be interested in conducting any interviews for your coverage. I encourage you to take a look at the report. It's quite an interesting one and ties directly to some of the issues that are going to be on the agenda at UNGA in New York. And please do not hesitate to reach out to us, newsroom@ilo.org, if you would like to speak to any of our experts or spokespeople. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zeina. Ravi, is that a question for Zeina? You need to unmute yourself. I can't hear you. I'm sorry. I see your hand, but we can't hear you. Oh, now you are on.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for this social justice report information. But what I want to know is that the Trump administration has not paid its dues to the ILO. Yet ILO is appointing a White House official as Deputy Secretary General. Does it actually add credibility to what ILO is doing?
Zeina, wait, you're not on. Please unmute yourself. Okay, now we can hear.
Apologies for that. I was saying thank you very much for the question, Ravi. There is no confirmation of any new appointment so far for the ILO. Happy to answer any other questions you may have if you'd like to reach out by email.
Thank you very much. Don't see other questions for you, Zeina. So thank you very much for this announcement. So I'll go to Nina now, and Tariq is on the line to answer you.
Great. Hi, Tariq. I just wanted to ask about the decision yesterday by the vaccine panel that's been appointed by the health secretary in the U.S., which has decided to remove the advice against kids receiving the MMRV vaccine up to the age of 4. Does the WHO have any thoughts on that? Thank you.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Nina. In fact, what we recommend when it comes to measles, rubella, mumps, and varicella. So we recommend that all children receive 2 doses of measles vaccine, either alone or in measles rubella, which is called MR, or trivalent measles mumps rubella, or quadrivalent measles mumps rubella and varicella combination. So this should be a standard for all national immunization programs, so to get that. Now, we recommend that the use of varicella vaccine for the prevention of varicella in children population where varicella is considered an important public health problem, and then it really depends on countries. Now, we recommend of either single antigen varicella or MMRV combination. Now, countries need to be aware of the observed increased risk for febrile seizures following the first dose of MMRV combination vaccine compared with using MMR vaccines or MMR plus varicella separately. So basically, this is what we understand that the committee has been raising, and it's the same what we state in our measles position paper of risk. So that's why the US was giving the parents the choice to use either quadrivalent MMRV in one or to use MMR and varicella separate. I can send you all this because there's lots of little combinations there, so I can send you all this by email.
Thanks, Tarek. My understanding is that the U.S. Was already giving this option to do it separately. So I'm wondering if this high-profile decision, if you're worried that it might undermine even further the confidence in vaccines, that there are all these decisions coming out that are saying that vaccines are dangerous. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, I'll explain to you on this specific point this is not something that we should be worried about because there is a slight increase, more of a mild and short-lived reaction to MMRV comparing to MMR and varicella given separately. We have to see what else will come out, but we definitely stand at the position that vaccines are safe. They are saving millions of lives every year of children, and we continue to monitor the safety of vaccines. We know that vaccines are the best public health product that we have.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tarek, for joining the briefing. I don't see other hands up, so I have quite a few announcements today for you indeed. Let me start with the usual information about the human rights treaty bodies. As you know, we still have the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which is concluding this morning the review of the report of LAOPDR. This is the last country that they had on their calendar. The Committee on Enforced Disappearances will open next Monday at 10 a.m. its 29th session, which will go on until the 2nd of October at Palais Wilson, during which it will hold dialogues under the Article 29.4 of the Convention with Montenegro, Benin, Sri Lanka, and the committee will also hold its annual meeting with states and civil society organizations on 26th of September. This is about the meetings of the treaty bodies. On the press conferences, let me remind you, on Monday, 22nd of September, the situation of human rights in the Russian Federation. This is by OHCHR with Mariana Katsarova, UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Russian Federation. The issue is, we had announced it at 9:30. We know it will be moved. We don't have final confirmation about the hour. We think it will be 11:30. So not at 9:30, but probably at 11:30 to be confirmed. Solange will send you the revised announcement as soon as possible. Yeah, that's on Monday 22nd. So we will try to give you the exact hour today already. We're waiting for colleagues to confirm, but Solange will inform you. The Monday other press conference is at 1 p.m. It's the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela with the three members of the mission. They will launch their latest reports to the Human Rights Council. They present it to you. On Tuesday, 23rd of September at 2 p.m., the group of human rights experts on Nicaragua will launch their latest report, and this is also with the three members of the group. And Katrin has already told you about the press conference of UNCTAD on Wednesday. And this is about the presser. Now, A few announcements on next week that, as you know, will see the world looking at New York, where our colleagues will be holding the main week of the high-level week of the session of the new session of the General Assembly. So I'd like to start. Sorry, because I've got many emails today here. So I'd like to start by reminding you that the United Nations will resume the high-level international conference for the peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine and the implementation of the two-state solution, which is co-chaired by France and Saudi Arabia, in accordance with the General Assembly decision during its 80th session. The conference will be held on Monday, 22nd September, at 3 p.m. in the General Assembly Hall. It will reaffirm international commitments to the two-state solution and seek to mobilize support for its implementation. This is all live streamed, so you will be able to follow it on UN Web TV. And let us know, we have a couple of colleagues from the Department of Global Communication who are working on this, and they can inform you if needed, if you have questions. Another thing I wanted to to highlight about the General Assembly is happening today. UNGA important event happening today, unfortunately late for Geneva, but I really wanted to underline. We will have a commemoration of the UN at 80, a living legacy. This will happen in the General Assembly Hall in New York. The Secretary General will open the meeting with opening remarks, and the event will feature A Living Legacy, a short film by award-winning director Mr. Sing Lee, and producer and creative director Mrs. Sylvia Zakari. They will bring the story of the United Nations to life, its people, milestones, and impact on the world over the past 8 decades, building our future together. The commemoration will also include live performances by Tiwa Savage and the UN Chamber Music Society, and there will be closing remarks by UN Women Executive Director Mrs. Sima Bahous, Under Secretary General for Management, Strategy, Policy, and Compliance, Mrs. Catherine Pollard, and the UN Deputy Secretary General, Mrs. Amina Mohammed, who will close the meeting. As I said, this is a commemoration that will happen quite late in the evening. That will be at 6:30 in New York, so midnight here, midnight 30, but it will be webcast, and it will be possible to watch it later on UN Web TV. So that is one other thing I wanted to announce you. Yesterday we sent you the information about the report of the Secretary General on the work of the organization in 2025. The title of the report is For Humanity, Report of the Secretary General on the Work of the Organization 2025. It presents how the United Nations Secretariat has translated resources into results over the past year. The report is available in six official languages and in two accessibility formats in line with our disability inclusion strategy. It presents our work to support member states in driving the 2030 agenda, advancing climate action, promoting gender equality, protecting human rights, advancing peace and security, coordinating humanitarian assistance, promoting justice and international law, furthering disarmament, increasing drug control, preventing crime, combating international terrorism, and consolidating the UN reforms. And I really invite you to take time to read the report. It is available to be downloaded on UN Geneva website in English and in French. I would also like to come back to a couple of announcements in Geneva, of things happening in Geneva. The first one is that we are 2 weeks away from Building Bridges 2025. We have distributed to you a press release which announces that Secretary John Kerry and Councillor Martin Pfister will be among the featured speakers at the sixth edition of the Building Bridges, which will open in Geneva with these two speakers, but many more, you have a list of the participants following the links in the press releases. We will have all these people, it's more than 2,000 leaders from finance, government, international organizations, civil society, and academia, gathering from the 30th of September to the 2 of October at the SCICG here in town. There is a media program related to the Building Bridges event. The first will be on Tuesday, 30th of September at 8:15. There will be a press briefing ahead of the summit. And then on Wednesday, 1st of October, you will have a media workshop, Greening the Newsroom to Build Resilience in Times of Turbulence and Disruptions, again at 8 o'clock for those who wake up early. On Thursday, 2nd of October at 8:15, there will be a morning press briefings at the ground floor of the CICG. A nice event that we celebrate every year, International Day of Sign Language. This is on Tuesday, 23rd of September here at the Palais des Nations. It's organized by us with the permanent mission of Cuba and the Dominican Republic. I'll invite you to stop by the Sign Language pop-up cafe. This will be from 1 to 3 p.m. in the Salon Suisse, just above our heads, to enjoy complimentary coffee, tea, and croissant, and learn how to order in sign language. It's always a very nice event. Last but definitely not least, we have sent you the message of the Secretary General for the International Day of Peace, which we commemorate on the 21st of September. I will not read the statement because you have it in your mailbox, but I will invite you to look at it and, of course, speak about this very important International Day, especially at the moment. So, sorry for the very long list of announcements. Christian.
Is sign language universal, or is this the Spanish version of sign language
learn? It's a good question, and I don't know. I think it's international, but I will have to ask. Sign language, as you know, is a national language, but there is, I understand, but please don't quote me, I will have to check this, there is an international sign language, and that is what we commemorate. But I will come back to everyone with a little note on this and maybe a little bit more information on the events so that you will all come there and learn how to order in this language. Body.
We've got your email for John Kerry in CSCG, but do we need to require the new accreditation?
Ah, okay. No, I don't think this is the case. Looking at Francois, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it's the case. For the permanently accredited journalist of UNOG, I think you will not need reaccreditation, no. Any other question? Online? Yeah, John.
Hi, Alessandra, on that comment concerning CICG and no need for extra accreditation, it's been an incredible problem for UN-accredited reporters on most events there. Can we get it in writing that we will not require any special accreditation to show security when we go there? Thank you.
Look, in principle, when we have reaccreditation of events, they give us this information because, as you know, this is a UN Geneva event, and we meaning us really in UNIS, we accredit the journalists. So I will have to ask, but nobody has raised this question, which makes me really think that this should not be a problem. But you are right, John. Better to have it in writing, better to check than not check and then have a problem later on. So I will do it with pleasure. So I have two homeworks, sign language and building bridges. And maybe I will ask our colleague, Edward, next week to come and tell you a little bit more about the program himself so that you can have more information from the horse mouth, so to speak. Any other question? I don't see any. So thank you very much to everybody. Bon appétit and have a nice weekend. Thank you.